arrival of Western civilization. It's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Constance Cumby, who is a lawyer, practices back in Detroit, Michigan. But of course, back in the 1980s, Constance was writing about the New Age movement and really introduced me to this whole concept of the fact that there really were people who were in contact with the other dimension, people who were actually involved in the worship of different gods, strange and mysterious gods that are really out there. And of course, this is really the sort of the key to understanding what energizes so many of the people who are dedicated now to this idea of a one world government. But more recently, why, of course, Constance has been studying the career of a European diplomat, probably the single most powerful man in the world, and yet most Americans have never heard of Javier Solana. So with that as a background, Constance, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, as always, for the opportunity.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the latest information, because apparently there is some late information since we last spoke. But for our listeners, and we have a large audience now in the eastern part of the United States and then certainly in eastern Washington, why don't you give a little background of who Javier Solana is?
Well, Javier Solana's current title is Office of the High Representative of the Common Foreign and Security Policy for the European Union. Simultaneous with that title, he holds another title called Secretary General of the Council of the European Union, or Secretary General of the European Union. And he also has another hat called Secretary General of the Western European Union, which is a military federation that was 10 permanent members and I think maybe 18 affiliate members. And supposedly they were folding their powers on Solana's agency with the European Union, but then he found a reason why that couldn't happen, he said, according to treaties, and so they remain a separate organization and a handy hat for him to wear whenever there is dissension within the European Union. Formerly, between 1995, December 1995, and October 1999, he was Secretary General of the of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the head of NATO, who possessed very unusual powers. On January 30th, 1999, he was given sole power to make the military decisions over Yugoslavia, including whether to bomb or not. And usually the head of NATO had been, the Secretary General of NATO had been ministerial. He would take direction from the countries and then pass those directions on to the NATO generals. But this time Solana acted as the director of all the countries, the NATO generals, everybody. He was the supreme commander, in effect, instead of the supreme commander named General Wesley, who took his orders from Javier Solana. And this is the man who was on the United States subversive list for many years, for subversive activities and expressed attitudes towards the United States in the 1960s.
Now, of course, the thing is that he made the decision to bomb Kosovo, and yeah, and so our planes and Europe, primarily our planes and a few British planes, actually carried out the directives of this man who, at one time, was on the subversive list.
Yes, Wesley Clark took his orders from Javier Solana, and very dutifully took those orders. And, yes, he had been on our subversive list, and this shocked many people who knew him from the leftist circles because he was officially a Marxist until September 29, 1979. However, I have a very clear photograph of him from 1983 giving the Marxist salute and an obvious Marxist-Leninist meeting in 1983, and those were his more mature years. And but some of his friends from the left were caught with shock when he was supposedly a peace-loving man was acting as a first-rate, as they put it, warmonger.
All right, fine. And, of course, you have commented one time that Bill Clinton went on television and said, I agree with Javier Solana's decision.
That is true. Right. Bill Clinton did that on March 21st, 1999. That was the day that CBS interrupted its Sunday morning program to say, we interrupt this program to bring you a very important announcement. Javier Solana, the Secretary General of NATO, has announced that the bombing of Yugoslavia may start as soon as the next few hours. And that was the day I did the research and discovered that he had been given those powers on January 30th, 1999, according to Madeleine Albright. And that night, President Clinton came on national television to talk about it, to inform the American public. He never said, this is what I think we should do, this is what we think we should do, or even this is what the heads of the world community think would be wise. He said instead, I agree with Javier Solana's decision to do this. And fascinatingly, nobody in the public media ever said, who's Javier Solana?
And then, of course, recently, when the United States tendered a peace offer along with the European Union, it was primarily European Union, but America went along with it, and that was on June 6th of this year, 666, June 6th, year 2006, was Javier Solana actually took the offer to negotiate to Tehran?
He represented the United States, he represented China, he represented Russia, he represented the European Union, he represented from the Security Council of the United Nations, and he also represented Germany as part of its United Nations membership, even though it's not part of the Security Council. He represented six different political entities, and he did this on June 6th of year 2006. And on that date, our President, George W. Bush, went on national television and expressed his deepest gratitude to Javier Solana for doing this.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment as we bring all of our other stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Constance Cumby, and she was simply pointing out that Javier Solana really is probably the single most powerful man in the world today, and yet most Americans have never heard of him. We were just pointing out that on June 6th, the year 2006, in other words, 666, why Javier Solana had actually taken the peace offer, or offer to negotiate, from six different entities and had taken them into Tehran. And that was, of course, earlier this month. And now we're waiting to see what Iran would do. But the fact that he would represent not only the United States, but the European Union and Germany and Russia and China, and he would be their representative to Tehran. A very unusual situation and a very unusual date for a very unusual man. So, but you commented now there's something much more recent. In fact, didn't you say that immediately after this that President Bush had gone on television and commented how much indebted he was to Javier Solana for having taken that peace initiative?
Yes, he expressed his deepest gratitude to Javier Solana for accomplishing this mission, and that was he said that on June 6, 2006. And then, are you interested in the later development?
Yes, I certainly am.
Okay. June 21st, 2006, a statement was issued from the White House, President George W. Bush, U.S.-EU Summit Declaration Promoting Peace, Human Rights, and Democracy Worldwide. And the European Union issued equivalent statements and has very ample copies of documents on their website as well. And this one startled me because it declared that they were going to work with the European Union on the Barcelona process. That's where I came in 1995. The horrible thing I discovered, it made me start tracking Javier Solana day and night. The European Neighborhood Policy, and that's the seven-year process that will open January 1st, 2006, with a review period 3.5 years into that. And the various other European initiatives and reform, they said the Middle East Partnership Initiative and our joint actions on the broader Middle East and North Africa Initiative and the Foundation and Fund for the future. And the interesting thing about the Barcelona process, one of their first and foremost and publicly avowed goals is to battle religious fundamentalism worldwide. You're allowed to have a religion in the New World Order. You are not allowed to believe it's true.
All right. And, of course, now this is part of this overall conspiracy against God that we keep talking about, an organized effort to destroy any belief in the God of the Bible.
Certainly looks that way. I have more than a sneaking suspicion. In fact, I think I've pretty much documented at this point that his family, at least, was deeply caught up, even though he personally appears to be an atheist, that his family was deeply caught up in the whole Lucis Trust network. His grandfather was on the board of endorsers for Planetary Citizens, which was headed by a Lucis Trust administrator, Donald Keyes. His grandfather was close to H.G. Wells and several others who were mapping out blueprints for the new order, and his grandfather had been the chief of the disarmament section at the League of Nations. And I've found that his mother had as her personal guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, also known as Osho, who was causing chaos in our state of Oregon for quite some time and was finally deported. And the family seems to have been orbiting in those directions. The only flag that he has flown directly and openly and publicly in that direction personally is the Club of Rome. But that's a significant flag.
Yeah, but that's really not a religious organization as such, is it?
They sometimes define themselves as political, spiritual, or spiritual, political.
All right. Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there wasn't a spiritual
component. In fact, the current president of the Club of Rome and a very close friend of Javier Solana's is the former crown prince of Jordan, Prince Hassan. And he currently is the Club of Rome, and he is very actively working on some form of hope for global syncretism, some type of a new world religion where everybody compromises and blends their differences.
Okay, sort of like the Baha'i religion, that all religions are one.
Something like that, and it's kind of hard to say whether this guy sincerely believes what he's doing or if he was appointed because they wanted some royal blood to fill that seat, which had been held by Aurelio Pecci for years. But he has been unabashedly talking about the worldwide dangers of fundamentalist religion and the need for all religions to dialogue and come together as one.
Because I think for our listeners, perhaps you could tell them a little bit about the Club of Rome, because a lot of them may not be really aware of the power of this group, who these people are and how they tie into royalty and Gorbachev and communism and Marie Strong and the Earth Charter and this whole internationalist movement.
Well, Marie Strong is another very interesting character maybe even more important than the Club of Rome is the triangle these folks think they have established between their new global triangle is the European Union, NATO, and the United Nations. Now, Maurice Strong mentored Kofi Annan, who is the current head of the United Nations. And Maurice Strong is a very open devotee of everything Lucis Trust and the Christ is Now Here crowd stand for. I actually have a photograph of him that was published by Lucis Trust on one of its websites of their group making a trip to Findhorn Foundation in Scotland to meditate and pray to whatever they're praying to for their new Christ to make his emergence, to fully emerge. And there, as big as life, stands Maurice Strong right in the middle of their number.
Well, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the Lucis Trust? Because this is really one of the most important organizations in the world today, and yet the average person has never heard of it.
Well, Lucis Trust is an outgrowth of another organization called the Theosophical Society. It was formed by two former officers of the Theosophical Society who were married to each other and went from California, where they worked for society offices in Southern California, to start to work in New York. They went to New York, and in 1922, Alice Bailey and Foster Bailey, her husband, a lawyer and the former treasurer of the Theosophical Society, and she'd been the national editor, organized Lucifer Publishing Company.
The Lucifer, that suggests that they are already sort of tied into the Luciferian worship.
Well, yes, and the Theosophical Society itself had a magazine called Lucifer. And in 1892, the founder of the Theosophical Society, Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, announced to her membership that what they were really all about was not the study of comparative religions, as many believe, but what they were really all about was preparing the world to receive a new Messiah who would be known as Maitreya the Christ. And in 1910, the Theosophists thought they had identified him, and in many works and many deviant works started the Anthroposophical Society, is an outgrowth of the Theosophical Society, Lucis Trust. And they were busy preparing the world for what was to be this advent in the 1920s, and in 1929 they thought the big day would come. And it was so powerfully advanced, they were controlling governments in some countries, Costa Rica being one notable country where this happened, and there had been revolutions, and those opposed to the Theosophical doctrines had been driven out of the country and exiled elsewhere if they were lucky enough to live. Mexico had banned Christianity, and from 1926 to approximately 1938 in the last of the provinces, 1926 to 1935 officially in all the provinces, it was unlawful to, basically it was unlawful to worship. And the Bible was banned for the masses. And Christians were hanging from every utility pole in the country. But while this was going on, the Theosophical Society built a handsome new headquarters in Mexico City. Krishnamurti's The Order of the Star was flourishing throughout Mexico. And the general that was ordering so much of the killing, and who took a trip over the countryside with the Lindberghs the weekend of the most blatant, widespread murders of Christians, it turns out he was a Theosophist the entire time. Hitler in Nazi Germany had studied Theosophy. And several of his top lieutenants were into it, and basically had taken their notions of a cleansing action and the Aryan master race from Theosophical books. They did not obtain those notions from a vacuum, as many thought, and they were actively hooking up with Tibetan Buddhists at that point and cultivating their favor. Hitler even reportedly had 300 Tibetan Buddhists on his staff advising him all through the war. Towards the end of the war, when it looked like he was losing, he decided maybe it was the master's fault, and he decided to take it out on their earthly instruments. The agents, the Tibetan Dalai Lama underlings working for him, and he ordered their rations cut to those of a concentration camp prisoner. And when they went to deliver the second meal, they discovered all 300 had a knife in their belly in an identical spot. They had committed mass suicide rather than undergo the humiliation of being treated as a concentration camp prisoner.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Constance Cumby. And, of course, this is the key to understand the Nazi movement, which most people don't understand. It was all founded in the same occult movement, which is so prevalent in America today. Well, Constance, let's go ahead and pick up the story, because I think it's so important that people have an understanding of the background of the Lucius Trust, especially when we find some of Javier Solana's relatives associated with the Lucius Trust.
There are some, supposedly they tried many times to get Salvador de Madariaga to come speak to their gatherings at the Bollingen at the Iranis School of Spiritual Research, which was co-founded by Alice Ann Bailey and Olga Freebie Captain, and supposedly they were unsuccessful in landing him as a speaker. However, reading the Alice Bailey books and her instructions to disciples, there are instructions to a Spanish disciple where the description fits nobody but Salvador de Madariaga, Javier Solana's grandfather and mentor. And Solana also flies very openly his headship of the Madariaga Foundation. So it looks like there was the closest of interaction between these, and that perhaps he was even groomed for this position. Although it's his reportedly his grandfather was so anti-clerical, hated religion, hated God so much, he did not permit his daughters, either Solana's mother Neves or his aunt Isabel, who's a professor at a London university, to be baptized. And Solana grew up in that type of milieu. He has publicly expressed contempt for religion on many occasions. In 2003, he expressed dismay that the United States was too religiously driven, and that we thought in binary terms, black and white, whereas the Europeans thought in shades of gray. And then he mocked the United States money. He said, the United States, he said, they have in God we trust on their money. He said, can you imagine that on the euro? He said, never. He said, in Europe, we're more secular. And then when the Pope died, Pope John Paul II, he issued a very curious statement. Usually his press releases are well-written, elegant. This one said, condolences to the Catholic Church on the disappearance of its spiritual leader.
On the disappearance, not the death.
Disappearance, yes.
Well, anyway, of course, I think it's so significant that you have the feeling that there's an invisible force behind this one man. How could one man accumulate so much power today? Usually people are there for a short period of time, and then they, of course, are replaced by someone else. But it's almost as if there is an invisible hand guiding
his career. Well, I've certainly seen him come up from nothing. When I started my research, I was lucky to get, 60, 70, 80,000 AltaVista hits, which was Google's predecessor as a major search engine. And these days, on any average day, you're likely to get anywhere between almost 5 million and almost 9 million hits. I haven't done a Google count today to see how many he has, but it's certainly his publicity has accelerated many, many, many times, and his powers seem to have increased in the last month. Moreover, he had some humiliation in 2005 when the European Union proposed constitution went down by referendum in two countries, and that constitution was supposed to have given him superpowers as a foreign minister on steroids, and that the foreign minister really would have the bulk of power, and the president would be a handshaker with limited terms, and he would have all these powers and rights of initiative.
Hold that thought right there. We'd be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Constance Cumby, and she's basically been saying that Mr. Solana really is a fascinating individual. There's almost like a force behind him, propelling him into key positions. Of course, he did have a recent setback because, of course, the European Union constitution failed in both France and Holland. The people didn't want it, and had that gone through and the European Union Parliament accepted, why, certainly Javier Solana would have been the most powerful man in the European Union. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, he still is. They just it's basically accomplished by treaty. He badly wanted the Constitution to pass by popular referendum to give him some legitimacy, and it didn't happen. And a lot of people thought nothing to worry about, but now last week, he was given some very broad-based emergency powers over Europe. And a force, an emergency police force compiled of officers from all countries was put together, and it has been put fully under the authority and disposal of Javier Solana, as has the European space program.
And what about the European military? Don't they have a separate military unit?
The military is entirely under Solana. It reports entirely to him, and he is working on rapidly merging all of the European Union military into one consolidated force, and he's working on that, and treaties have been adopted that say basically these countries, if they want to be part of the European Union and have the economic benefits of the European Union, must cooperate with Javier Solana on this consolidation.
Now, that is different than NATO, isn't it?
That's what's interesting. Javier Solana has always said that the plan is to use NATO assets with European control of those assets. And he did sign the treaty. I believe it may have happened in 2002. And he's been saying this since I started observing him, even while he was still at NATO, he was saying that. And while he was still at NATO, he split the NATO command in two, with the USA command being in Norfolk and the European command being in Brussels. And basically, many of those officers are double-hatted. And if the United States says we don't want to get involved in something, then under existing treaties that now exist and have been signed, and interestingly enough, they said that the course of this took the course of letters between Javier Solana in his EU capacity and to his successor at NATO, Lord Robertson, and that the policy was established by letters between these guys, and so if the Europe wants to make use of these, and they have already exercised this, and the United States doesn't want to get involved in any exercise, then it's the European Union's to use, and use the equipment and use the manpower as they will.
But will they actually be separate military units, or will they be one and the same?
Well, it looks to me like it's the same guy sitting across the same table, across the street. They all know each other. They all talk to each other. They all have similar goals. Jamie Shea, who is the spokesperson for NATO, gave some talks on this and how terribly important it was that Europe now have control of these NATO assets, and so it is. And so it doesn't matter whether it's labeled NATO, whether it's labeled European Union. Of course, they're trying to bring as much equipment as possible under the direct title of the European Union. But they have working control of the rest of it.
Well, then, are they basically then squeezing the Americans out? Because Americans, at least for the last 50 years, have been an important part of NATO.
And don't forget, after 9/11, and they were patrolling, and NATO was patrolling our skies, all the lovely aerial photographs of all of our key installations.
In other words, they were all taken by NATO rather than our own public.
Yes, and Solana himself headed NATO for 4 years, and NATO is effectively now under European control. That was one reason when Rumsfeld was in Brussels last year and angry at the Belgians for saying they wanted war crimes trials against the Americans. And he threatened to have the United States withhold the money for building a new NATO headquarters in Brussels. And that was part of what had gone into that statement and into that thinking, was the knowledge that this was now controlled by the Europeans,
and of course,
who were anti-American.
And do you think increasingly there's an anti-American attitude in Europe?
Very heavy. Very, very heavy.
However, we're going to be back.
We are hated there, and they think they're equalizing themselves to us by handing power to Solana.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, understand there are lots of things going on behind the scenes that, you know, we don't understand here in America, but they all have spiritual significance. We'll be back in just a moment or two with Constance Cumby as we begin exploring more of this amazing man, the most powerful man in the world. Most people have never heard of. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Constance Cumby, and we're talking about her favorite subject, and that's Javier Solana. So why don't you pick up the story?
Okay. Well, he's been busy, and another one of his projects has been a permanent solution for peace in the Middle East. And he has been a player on that front since, remember back to 1991, when President Bush the elder, and Gorbachev held a joint conference on peace in the Middle East in a Madrid hotel room. Or a Madrid hotel. You remember those peace conferences?
Oh, very, very vaguely. Why don't you tell us
about
it?
Okay. Well, those peace conferences were major worldwide events, had lots of publicity. They were held in Madrid, Spain. Javier Solana coordinated them and organized them. And the two that were fronting it were the United States under George Bush, the father of our current president, and Mikhail Gorbachev. And then in when I discovered Javier Solana, which was November 22, 1995, he had just signed a treaty 2 days earlier between the European Union and Israel. And interestingly, and perhaps coincidentally, 2 days later, Israel had the strongest earthquake they have ever had in their earth in their history. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I was noting today that many places that had signed treaties with Javier Solana for surveillance and security had had some very strange earthquake phenomenon later, and one being Israel, November 22, 1995, 2 days after signing the treaty. Another, Indonesia, which has had nothing but trouble, the Aceh monitoring mission, which is an operation of the European Union led by Javier Solana, with the chain of command ending with Solana. And the Congo, which signed a similar agreement with him and then had a very horrible earthquake last fall of 1995, not too long after that mission with the European Union began. It could all be coincidence, but it certainly was interesting.
I know it's provocative. It gets you thinking, but what about this accord with Israel? An accord between Europe and Israel is a very interesting accord.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's been, and the first one was signed November 20th, 1995. It was to have gone into effect in 1997. It did not become officially ratified until June 1st, 2000.
Now hold that thought.
They counted the renewal program.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Stan, Constance is saying that it's very interesting that they signed a treaty. Javier Solana had supervised this treaty that was signed between Europe and Israel back in 1995. And then, of course, 2 days after the treaty was signed, there was an earthquake in Israel. And the same thing happened when, of course, the Congo signed a treaty with Europe. And then they had an earthquake. And there's a number of other instances are very, very similar. But certainly the European-Israeli treaty went into effect in the year 2000.
What it was June 1st, 2000.
What was
and then they treated it as though it was a seven-year period which was supposed to have arranged from 2004, and then in 2000, I think they did a renewal on it, but now it's to be superseded by the European Neighborhood Policy.
Now, what does this treaty have to do? I mean, why would Europe be signing a treaty with Israel?
Guarantee its security, of course, and give Israel trading rights and privileges with the European Union.
So it's really more or less a trade pact.
But it wasn't just a trade document. There were provisions in it against xenophobia, religious dialogue, cultural dialogue of all types. There were carrots and there were sticks.
Right.
It was a very encompassing treaty of association, and interestingly enough, the person controlling Europe's money was Wim Duisenberg, D-U-I-S-E-N-B-E-R-G, and his wife Greta Duisenberg was the leader of a movement that sought to have the European Union break this treaty with Israel, the Treaty of Association. And the Simon Wiesenthal Institute asked Javier Solana to please revoke her European Union passport. They had EU passports as well as individual country ones. And that was a joke because she certainly would not have been out doing it without Javier Solana's blessings.
All right, and so we see this treaty that's in place. What about, is there anything at all going on between Israel and the Vatican that you've come across?
Between Israel and the Vatican?
The Vatican, right.
No, not significant. That's not to say it's happening. I just have not found it personally. I've been much more interested in what the European Union has been doing to ensure security there. And knowing this of Solana's anti-clericalism, you have to understand that Lucis Trust considers Jews, Catholics, and Muslims, and Protestant and Catholic Christians alike as the enemy. And they also have an avowed strategy that I've always looked out for, and that is to pit the target groups against each other, to basically termites from within, wrecking balls from without, get us all busy fighting each other. Peter Lemasurier, the author of the Armageddon script, wrote that plans to stage a phony second coming of Christ from the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem with sufficient detail to make the average Christian Jew and think it was their Messiah, and the Muslim to think it was their Imam Mahdi, and that they wouldn't have to worry about the old age, that the massed forces of the old age would go on to defeat each other in a massive mutual venting of long pent-up aggression. And then they would be the phoenix that would rise from the ashes.
And what you're suggesting is then they are going to try to get a Mideast war going.
Oh yes, they're anticipating that, and it's fascinating how they've structured it, because it's structured so just about everybody can participate. The atheists can participate because they just think it's acting out Jungian archetypes and getting this out of people's collective subconscious. The new agers can participate because they think this is going to usher in their new metaphysical world dream, and that the others will be busy fighting each other, but they're going to be staging this. And Lemasurier wrote some fascinating language in his book. He said their script is now written, subject only to last-minute editing and stage directions. He says that the stage itself, albeit as yet in darkness, is almost ready. Down in the pit, the subterranean orchestra is already tuning up, ready for the curtain to rise. The walk-on parts even now are waiting in the wings. The time for action will have come.
Now, that's called the Armageddon plot?
That was the Armageddon script by Peter Lemasurier, a noted New Age writer who wrote that book originally for Findhorn Foundation's Thule Press, T-H-U-L-E, which was the same name as the super-secret organization the Nazis had in the 30s.
Well, is that book still available? Is it still in print?
I have a copy of it on my shelf. I imagine if people go on the Internet, they can find copies available, maybe through Amazon.com. I have a couple of copies of it in my own personal library, I quoted from it heavily in my second book, A Planned Deception.
All right. Could you tell the spelling of the last name of that gentleman?
L-E-M-E-S-U-R-I-E-R. Lemasurier.
Okay, fine. Well, very often these people tell us exactly what they're planning on doing. What this was supposed to be, what about almost 20 years ago he wrote that?
Yes. It was 25 years ago. He wrote it in 1981, the same year that I discovered the New Age movement. And it's very interesting. I'm amazed at how many New Age books to this day talk about me as being a serious impediment to their plans.
Well, I think you should be rather flattered.
I found it flattering. At the same time, it's a little alarming to see that they're still that worried about one book and its writer. Benjamin Krem used to say on his radio interviews that Constance Cumby would pay dearly for her interference with the plan. And fascinatingly, on some of the Google, not Google, but Ask, which used to be AskJeeves.com and Taoma and Hotbot and a dog pile and several similar search engines, they had my name as the only related name with Javier Solana. And then when you click on my name, they would have related names, Javier Solana, or related names Benjamin Krem and Javier Solana.
Well, for our listeners out there, of course, Constance Cumby's book, the really bad one, was The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, and we still carry the book.
Like to have a couple more copies of that. It's tough when an author has trouble laying their hands on a copy of their own book.
Well, of course, I think it was a terrible tragedy when Huntington House went out, and we bought a fair number that we have. Well,
is that where they went? They were supposed to have sent them to me under that settlement. Okay.
Well, at least we got a few of them.
At least you've got them. They're in good hands, and I feel better.
Well, if you want a couple of copies, I'll talk to the chief and see if we can get them for you.
Okay.
Well, I think it's so important, ladies and gentlemen, that you really, if you haven't read Constance's book, it still is a classic. The people on the other side hate it, and there really is another side, and it's not the communists. And it's not even necessarily the CFR, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Club of Rome. It's the spiritual force that energizes them. Would you agree?
Well, there's another way. There's another huge way they're coming in. And one of the things that the White House indicated they were going to be working with the European Union and Javier Solana on were the Kyoto Accords and climate control and global warming issues. And Saturday I had the opportunity to walk into a bookstore that's now in a different location. That was the store where I first started my research that led to my other writing, and that was a Cokesbury, a United Methodist bookstore. And they had a lot of good things in there. It was a lot cleaner than back when I was looking at it. But there was one book that caught my eye. It was called Greening Congregations Handbook: Stories, Ideas, and Resources for Cultivating Creation Awareness and Care in Your Congregation. And people need to know that this is a major component of the whole picture. They're calling it Earth Care. What it is, really, is Earth Worship. And rapidly they're taking folks into total lockstep with the rest of the New Age movement through this, using the same books, the same references, the same ideologies, but doing this under a veneer of religion, and that we're caring for the earth, and you read this carefully, and they're really worshiping an earth spirit, and some very dangerous ideas, and their ideas very similar to what the Nazis had about population reduction, and that human beings, really too many of us, have messed up the earth, and we have a duty to get out of the way and make room for the snail darters, etc., 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 and if we aren't for that, then basically we're guilty of speciesism. And a lot of this is being done under a veneer of religion, but it is New Age without even as much scratching as I had to do.
Well, I think
when I found it.
I think it's so interesting. I'm getting things all the time. In the name of religion, in the name of Christianity, after all, weren't we made stewards of the earth? I mean, we should be caring for the earth. We should be protecting the earth. We should be concerned about global warming. And if you're a Christian, if you read the things put out by Benjamin Krem and the occultists, they keep talking about the danger of global warming.
And I have a whole collection of New Age books back before they discovered global warming, when they said if we didn't do things their way, we would have a new ice age. So, you know, in true New Age fashion, I've recycled those books. And just for tongue-in-cheek, I thought they should issue a press release. And when we had a cold winter, and saying that they had discovered that they'd made a mistake in their projections, and that instead of global warming, we were now in for a period of global cooling, but not to worry, the same corrective measures that had ended global warming as quickly as it did also worked for global cooling, and they pledged to end global cooling just as fast and efficiently as they had ended global warming. And it's pretty clear somebody wants to take totalitarian control. And like Barbara Marx Hubbard said, we now have our crisis. She's another spokesperson for the movement who is close to this entire scene. And she said, the voices speaking through her said, we come to bring death. We do this for the sake of the planet. The Pale Riders are about to pass among you. And what's amazing is that the same prominent folks that were there when I started investigating the New Age movement are still there in the forefront of that movement. David Spangler, Barbara Marx Hubbard, Maurice Strong. But what is different now is that they have far more political power. And one major figure, Jeremy Rifkin, whom I've investigated since 1981 is a top advisor to the European Union top leaders, including Javier Solana, who likes to quote Rifkin in his speeches.
Wasn't it Rifkin who talked about the Luciferian initiation?
That was David Spangler about the Luciferic initiation. Rifkin was the one who did the number on the evangelical churches and wrote a book called The Emerging Order, God in an Age of Scarcity, and told the Christians to rewrite their theology. and that this would be the, that he said only the religious impulse was strong enough to put this thing over the top, and that it would be done in the name and spirit of orthodoxy, and that it would be done by changing the paradigm from a religious, from a fallen dominion paradigm to a stewardship paradigm that would address and care for the planet. Now, you know, anybody who has oily water in their backyard instantly be an environmentalist, myself included, but these folks are taking it to other dimensions. They're taking it to the dimensions of what Hitler called Lebensraum, living space, breathing space, and basically their concept is that there need to be far fewer people to give those would-be supermen more energy, that since the amount of energy is limited, that we need fewer people to have a stronger race of fewer people. To have a Superman emerge, we need to have lots of people disappear.
And, of course, I think they really do intend to kill off a large part of the world's population. You see that in some...
You look at Africa some nights, and it looks like they're succeeding. I will swear what I've been watching on television under the guise of sometimes humanitarian operations are incited death marches.
And, of course, we find here our CIA has been financing the warlords in Somalia to fight the Islamic rebels, and yet, of course, we originated this whole thing movement. We began financing all this, you know, during the Afghan War, financing this whole radical Islamic movement. So we finance both sides, as we did in the Iran-Iraq War, or at least supply weapons to both sides, and then wonder why so many people get killed.
When you consider that back in 1985, Arthur Eggendorf wrote that 85 of our very finest generals had been trained in the best consciousness-raising techniques of the New Age. Now, with them having the agenda that they had, and the clear agenda of massive global, two-thirds global population reduction, wouldn't it make sense that with a philosophy that you had everybody busy fighting each other and you were the phoenix that arose from the ashes, there's some horrible twisted logic in that.
Well, I think sometimes I think we live in a world gone mad, but we've not really gone mad. If you understand that there are these other forces out there, then it all begins to make sense. It's just that they hate God's humanity.
They hate God, and another thing that has occurred to me more than once is this could just be just plain prophetic fulfillment. On the other hand, God has used people to hold evil back many times in the past, so we're to keep on keeping on until it's over.
Amen to that. Somebody just called in. They wanted if you could quote again the title of that book on greening that you mentioned earlier.
Greening Congregations Handbook.
Greening Congregations Handbook.
Book, and it is published by an organization in Seattle. In fact, they have a website, worldwideweb.earthministry.com. I'm not sure if it's com or earthministry.org. This particular one is Seattle-based, but since at least the United Methodist Church was using it, but from their from the list of contributions to the book and indicators of where it's being used lots of other places too. There are endorsements on the back. Let's see, from the General Secretary of the National Council of Churches, Larry Rasmussen, the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics, Union Theological Seminary. David Orr, Professor of Environmental Studies at Oberlin College. Sally McFaig, the Carpenter Professor of Theology Emeritus at Vanderbilt Divinity School. And Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature. And he's a Methodist lay leader and former New Yorker staff writer. But it was up there as a book that was being used actively for Sunday school classes, at least in the United Methodist Church.
And, of course, the thing is that the people on the other side have always intended to use the Christian church for its own destruction. In fact, if you read what Barry Goldwater wrote about the Trilogy Commission in his book With No Apologies, he talked about how they intended to take over control of the political and economic, but they always intended to take over the ecclesiastic. In other words, they were going to, by controlling the church, they would be able to control the people.
And that's like they thought that you would have to have a religious fervor to put this thing over the top. And by doing that, they would be neutralizing one of their potential sources of opposition. And at the same time, they would be weakening people. They would be weakening the opposition, marginalizing the opposition. And, you know, the ugliest opposition I had over the years on laying this out for people. It basically came from so-called evangelical critics who were basically telling people, go back to sleep, nothing's happening.
And, of course, that's exactly what they want. The one thing that they fear is that the Christians may understand we're involved in a spiritual battle. And behind all of these forces we talk about, communism, Council on Foreign Relations, Masonry, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Club of Rome, there's so many others, are these powerful spiritual forces moving us towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. Well, Constance, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up this evening's program. I think we could go on for another hour or two, but unfortunately, it's getting late back there, and I know you are still working there in the office, aren't you?
I am. I'm getting ready. I'm going to Oregon in a couple more days to speak for a week, and I forgot how stressful going on the road could be. So I'm busy trying to organize and get back in groove, and it's like I've been reviewing my work for the last 25 years.
Are you going to be talking on the New Age movement?
I'm going to be talking about the New Age movement. I'm going to be talking about the European Union. I'm going to be talking about the growing apostasy within the churches.
I hope maybe
the theology is altered.
I hope maybe you'll be able to get some good DVDs or videos and let us take
a look. That's what I've been doing. I finally was able to obtain a professional DVD duplicator, and I have been transferring tapes to many rare tapes over the years that people have been begging for, and I didn't have the methods to copy it efficiently, but now I can burn them onto DVDs, which are much easier to transport and play, and I will be making those available increasingly from now on.
Good. Well, I think Sydney's looking forward
and
to seeing them.
And basically, if I could just say one more thing to wrap up, there's a lot of information out there that's scary, and the reason I present it is not to frighten everybody to death. I think that there's a terrible job facing us, how to wake people up without frightening them to death, and people do need to wake up, but they also have to remember that the name of this game is put your trust in God. And if you trust God, you're going to come through this thing just fine. Nothing can happen until God is ready. If God's fully ready, there's nothing we can do to stop it. But remember, you have to account to God when you're done. There is no advantage in the here or in the hereafter to worshiping the earth, worshiping somebody that the New Agers designate, or subverting your theology towards the idol of many of the New Agers, Lucifer. And we have to place our trust in God. And if we do that, he'll bring us through this thing, and we'll be on top in the end.
Well, I certainly concur in everything you say. And, of course, our whole purpose of our ministry is to try to let people begin to put this all together, to understand that there are these other dimensions, there are these people who are tied into this, and of course they're waiting for the great
rapture. They need to put it together, but they have to remember to not fear him who can kill the body and thereafter do no more to you, to fear him who can kill both and cast both into hell. And basically, we're being presented with choices that Adam and Eve made, and they didn't make the wisest choice at the time. And we're going to have an opportunity to choose between God and Antichrist forces, and it's very important that we choose God.
God bless. Thanks so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Constance was wrapping up the program, and she just said that, in essence, what we say, we're involved in a spiritual battle, and you're going to have to choose between Christ and the Antichrist, and believe me, the Antichrist is going to have a very, 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 very appealing message, world peace, prosperity, and just, of course, renounce your belief in God. Renounce your belief in Christ. So understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. If you're interested in getting Constance Cumby's book, we do carry that. It's called The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. That's The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. We have a 4-tape sets on what's happening in the church today, the church growth movement. We have Dr. Click's excellent DVD going into the background of the church growth movement. We have books on the supernatural. We have the book The Beautiful Side of Evil, written by Johanna Michelson, who was a medium. And then, of course, we have my interviews with her and with certainly other people who are involved with the occult called the supernatural. We have books on Satanism. We have a 4-tape set on Satanism and deliverance. And let me suggest that you we have the book that Diary of a Devil Hunter, written by a man who was deeply involved in the occult, came out, and then, of course, he's trying to wake people about what's going on, goes around lecturing to police forces, and then the FBI comes around afterwards and says, there's no Satanism, there are no satanic crimes, just forget about all these. It's all make-believe, and they're totally ignoring the fact that the fellow in Southern California, the Hillside Strangler, whatever they called him, you know, actually went around writing satanic symbols on the palm of his hand. Certainly, we know that David Berkowitz was part of a secret satanic cult, as was Charles Manson. That's all covered in a book called Ultimate Evil by Maury Torrey. That's the Ultimate Evil out of print, but it's worthwhile getting. Understand the powerful forces that are aligned against Christianity today. And what the church is doing, why the church is getting into the name it and claim it philosophy, you know, prosperity gospel, if you just give more money to the church, well, you're going to get a lot of money back again, and there's nothing in Scripture that tells us that. It says that the Lord will look after us, but certainly not he's going to make us prosperous. We see the big television church sweeping the world, and we see many of the ideas here in the United States being disseminated all over the world, and they're not founded in the gospel of Jesus Christ. They're founded in the gospel that's put forward by the other side, masking as Christianity. Christianity is under attack today, and this is what it's really all about. That's why the ACLU wants to take out all the religious symbols from our cemeteries. You go to Arlington Cemetery, there are no crosses there at all. Why are there no crosses? Because they don't want anything to honor Jesus Christ. I think I saw maybe three or four crosses in that whole cemetery. There were crosses there one time, and they took them all out. That's why they take God and prayer out of our schools. That's why they take the Ten Commandments out of our schools. That's why they want to take the Christ out of Christmas. Understand that there really is a conspiracy against God. And then, of course, once you read Constance Cumby's book, The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, you begin to understand who it is who's on the other side. So this is the time when we ask you to pray for America and to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders, and to pray for our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And certainly our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we hope that many of you will go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And then you can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day, either directly or indirectly. Remember, of course, we do carry the big Berkey products, and we carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and we have health products as well. And if you're interested in getting any of those, why, if you'd like to get our health catalog, why, give us a call. If you're in an area with fluoridated water, you need to stop drinking fluoridated water. It increases the incidence of heart disease and so many other terrible conditions. And of course, it has a tremendous impact on our minds and our fertility. And that, of course, is why Adolf Hitler actually fluoridated the water. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please don't call unless we ask for calls, because we have with us certainly one of my favorite guests, an old friend, Ralph Epperson. And Ralph, I've known for, I guess, probably 25 years or more. And he has certainly given his life to researching the Masonic movement and trying to wake people up as to the powerful influence of this secret society here in America. And, you know, if you go up on the Internet, you'll find all sorts of articles there that are planted to allay your apprehension. Oh, the Masons, the only secret that they have is they don't have any secret. Or the recent History Channel, a presentation about Masonry and about the Knights Templar. And it's really very, very cleverly done. They have all these Masons. And, of course, they just scoff at the idea that there's anything secret about their organization, or that the Masons had anything to do with the laying out of Washington, D.C., even though the book, which we carry, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, the foreword of this book about the Masonic and astrological influence on the laying out of Washington, D.C., is written by the man who leads the Scottish Rite Masons. And yet, of course, they ridicule these ideas, and they say there's absolutely nothing there. And yet, of course, they are a secret society. And, of course, when they tell me that they have no secrets, I say, well, is that why you killed Captain Morgan? Is that why the Masons killed Captain Morgan? And they have attempted to kill other people who've told the truth about that? Is that why you infiltrated the church and you go after any minister who dares to tell the truth? And Masonry still does operate under many of the secret rules of the ancient past. But the average Mason, I don't think, really understands what Masonry is all about. What are your thoughts on that, Ralph?
No, I agree with you, Dr. Stan. There's two layers inside the lodge, and it takes a little while to dig that out. But once you do, you understand that the average Mason has no comprehension as to what they're into.
And I think it's so vastly important that people understand that the idea that this is a fraternity within a fraternity comes from a book written by a Manly P. Hall, who was a 32nd degree Mason, but he was at a much higher level. He went off into the super high degrees, and he will tell you in his book, The Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, that Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, and not a fraternity of people who really enjoy having a good time and doing good and enjoy the camaraderie, but an inner fraternity involved with the study of the Arcanum and the Ancanorum. Arcanum and the Ancanorum, and you have to go to the dictionary to look that up, and that's the secret and the secret of secrets. What is the secret of Masonry, Ralph?
Well, there are really two, I think, Dr. Stan. Number one is that there, when you go back into the first degree of the Blue Lodge, the first of three, and then there's, you can stay there if you wish. When you go into the Blue Lodge, I'll call him the vice president, because I don't know. They might not mean much to any, the real name. But anyway, the vice president brings the initiate up to the president, and the president says, what do you seek for this man? And the vice president says, light. You want to keep? I hear the music.
We'll get back to it in just a minute. But the average individual has no idea what the light is. And the average person entering the lodge, he is intentionally deceived. If you doubt that, you only have to read Manly P. Hall's book, Morals and Dogma. He will tell you, we intentionally deceive the initiates because they do not let them know what the secret of Masonry is and what the light represents. Well, Ralph, pick the story up there.
Okay, first degree, the Mason, the vice president answers a question of the president. He's called a worshipful master, and, and the vice president's got some other title. Anyway, I'll just call him president, vice president, just for the sake of argument. He says to him, what do you seek for this, or ask for this initiate? And he says, light. And they don't explain what light is, but at the end of the third degree, as the mason is leaving, he learns that the light represents the true knowledge of deity. So the mason is asking for the true knowledge of deity. That's what they are seeking. Now notice, you don't find the true knowledge of deity in religion. You don't find it in the gospel. You don't find it from your priest or from Jesus or the Bible. You find it in the masons. And then after if you were given the book entitled Morals and Dogma, if you go there and read the explanation of the 14th degree, you learn that Lucifer is the light bearer, doubt it not. And now that means that you are now can link three particular statements. Number one, you ask for light. Light is the true knowledge of deity. And number three, the light comes from Lucifer. So then you are to conclude on your own as a mason that, oh, I see. That means that the light comes from Lucifer, and he is the true knowledge of deity. That's number one secret. Now notice, they can't say that directly, and they won't. Because if they did, then the mason would leave. Most masons would get up and leave. I don't want to belong, believe in Lucifer, Satan, the devil. So they say it in their own words that they deceive you, they lie to you, and that the explanations they afford you are not the true ones. And you're supposed to study and read and reflect. And when you do, you will learn the true knowledge of deity. That's secret number one. The second secret is revealed at the 30th degree, where the mason takes a sword in his hands and vows to destroy Christianity. That is said at the 30th degree. If you want the documentation for that from their own rituals, I would urge you to read my third book entitled Masonry, Conspiracy Against Christianity.
Well, of course, he actually swears to avenge the death of Jacques de Molay, isn't that it?
No, they actually take a vow to destroy tyranny, and the tyrant is represented by the tiara. And you learn that the tiara is the crown or the symbol of the Pope, which meaning Christianity. So they take a vow to destroy Christianity.
Now, I think it's so important that people understand that there's tremendous symbology, that these men go through all of this, and they're approaching the truth. And, of course, they equate Christianity with Catholicism. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I asked Ralph the direct question, what are the secrets of masonry? Well, the first one, of course, is that the mason is to search for the light. And what is the light? Well, the light is the source of the true God. And who is the true God? Well, you have to read, of course, Masonic literature. They're not going to come right out and tell you, but it's really there if you read it. For instance, in one of my recent newsletters, I think it was the April newsletter, I simply quoted about Albert Pike talking about how there were two gods. There was the supreme God of the universe, and then there was the lesser God who created the heaven and the earth. Now, wait a minute. I thought that the God we worship created the heaven and the earth. No, he is a lesser God. And as you read more and more, you find out that there really are two gods. In fact, in the Garden of Eden, Albert Pike talks about how, it was the wicked God who told, it was the demon who told Adam, Eve, not to eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but the good God, the angel of light, told it was all right to go ahead and eat it. And you're wondering, what are they talking about? I mean, the demon? They look upon the God that we worship as the demon. And, of course, much of this is quoted in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and certainly in much of Ralph's writing. So the God that they worship is Lucifer. And it's very, very obvious if you read the writings of Alida Petrovna Blavatsky or of Manly P. Hall or of Albert Pike, and many of these are actually quoted in my books and in Ralph's books, and we recommend Ralph's books to you. And then, of course, the second, of course, secret is that they are destroying Christianity. And would you tell us about that ritual that they have in the 30th degree once again?
Yes, there are three crowns, three skulls shown. And one skull has a tiara on it, one has a laurel wreath, and the third one has a crown. And the crown represents government, the laurel wreath represents Jacques de Molay, their great hero, and the jar represents the symbol or the marking, the headwear of the Pope. Now, in 1871, when Pike wrote these rituals, there really wasn't much of a Protestant movement. So he's talking about the Pope, but he's obviously referring to Christianity. So what he's saying is that tyranny, especially when it came to the killing of their great leader, Jacques Dumollet, the head of the Knights Templar, that the Catholic Church and the government colluded together at the time to kill their great leader. So they're taking a vow to destroy him.
This is in the 1300s.
That's correct.
And, of course, this is why today there's so many young men, the children of Masons, who joined the Dumollets to honor Jacques Dumollet, who was burned at the stake because he was a heretic, he was a Luciferian. And if you don't believe that, you can read the writings of Manly P. Hall, who admits he was a Luciferian. That's why they had to kill him.
That's right. Now, the reason that government and Christianity collude is because the government that we create in civilized societies is based upon the teachings of God. Why? We protect the right to life, which means we acknowledge the statement, thou shalt not murder. We acknowledge the statement, thou shalt not steal, which means we can punish thieves. We say to God, that you're supposed to be married, that when you do get married and you're supposed to stay with your wife forever, there should be no divorce. So what they do, that is government. That's the reason we have government in civilized societies. Notice that every society in the world that I can think of has a husband and wife getting married, and they raise their children until the children get old enough, and then sometimes the children take care of their parents. That's traditional all over the world. They're out to destroy that. They don't want the family. And that's all written in Karl Marx. It's all written in the writings of many other Masons. Marx, the communist, wrote that we're going to abolish the family, and that's why. So what they're saying is that government has got to be destroyed because government's based upon the laws of God. Now, these people don't believe in God, and they want the Masons and others, the New Age religion, want man to decide for himself what's right and wrong. Now, that's the lie that's offered to them by Satan in the Garden of Eden. That's where this whole thing starts. That's why this conspiracy traces their history back to the fall of Lucifer into this earth back at the beginning of time in the Garden of Eden, where man was taught by God not to eat of the knowledge of good and evil, the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, meaning that you sure are not to decide what's right and wrong. I'll show you and teach you, and then you'll be happy. But Satan said, no, you shall know. You can eat, as you pointed out, you can eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, and therefore you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. In other words, you are to decide for yourself. That's what these people believe in. Notice the book is entitled Morals and Dogma, so it's going to teach the morality of their religion called Masonry. That's the purpose of the book. And that, over and over again, in that Morals and Dogma book, you can read where Pike wrote that the ethics are situational. We are to decide for ourselves what's right and wrong. That's what this is all about. They want a society where each man can decide for himself what's right and wrong.
And, of course, this leads to moral anarchy. In other words, the Ten Commandments, and the reason they hate the Ten Commandments is because it has certain rules. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Thou shalt not bear false witness. And, of course, they don't want any restrictions. They want freedom. And their god, Lucifer, Satan, the yellow serpent, as Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the mother of the New Age, modern New Age movement, said in her book, The Secret Doctrine, Satan gives you total freedom. Isn't that wonderful? But, of course, what sort of world would it be if you had total freedom with no restraints upon any of us?
Well, you can see this explanation I just gave you very briefly in that book entitled A Bridge to Light. There is a picture, a drawing, reproduced by Rex Hutchins, the author, although the drawing is certainly not drawn by him or by the Masons. It goes way back, but it's a drawing of, as he calls it, an aged man and his reflection. Now, he knows that it's not a reflection, because a reflection would be the same drawing except reversed. Like if you see a mountain with snow on it reflected in a lake, you'll see the mountain with snow in it except upside down. So this is not an aged man and his reflection, and you can see that by just looking at the aged man and turning the picture around 90 degrees, or 180 degrees rather, turn around, and you can see that the bottom picture is a demon. But there's one very important thing that most people miss. When you look at the aged man in the top part of the drawing, he's got a crown on which is tied or connected or attached a cross. And then when you look at the demon, the crown is still there, but there's no cross. So that means that what you are seeing is that the aged man is the new civilization we're living under, where man is creates government to protect his God-given unalienable rights.
Well, I think, Ralph, we should point out to our listeners that the Bridge to Light is a book that is given to all Masons. Morals and Dogma was given to all Masons up until 1974, but they've systematically dumbed people down to the average Mason would be incapable of reading Morals and Dogma. In fact, any person has a difficult time reading it because it's written in esoteric terms and with so many references. I honestly think it was probably channeled to Albert Pike by the demonic spirits that controlled him, but be that as it may, they have the new book. It's called Bridge to Light, written by Rex Hutchinson. And, of course, that book is what every Mason is supposed to read. And I think it's so interesting that they have the man's reflection would be a demon.
Yes, well, that's what it is. And the cross is removed in the bottom picture, which means their government's going to be led by a demon, and there'll be no religion. And that's exactly what they want. And, by the way, that's exactly what Karl Marx the Communist wanted. That's why in my second book, The New World Order, in my third book, In Masonry as well, I quote Karl Marx, because Karl Marx laid out the foundation of what these people want, the destruction of family, religion, morality, private property, you name it. There will be none of that in the New World Order.
That's where we're going. Karl Marx was a Satanist. We carry a book written by Reverend Wurmbrand. Karl Marx was a Satanist, and of course Reverend Wurmbrand had been arrested by the communists and tortured for 14 years. Yeah. Most of the people were with him. They broke their spirit, they destroyed their minds, they went mad, they committed suicide, but he held out and eventually was released. And he didn't make any sense. He didn't figure, what if the communists wanted to get rid of him, why didn't they just put him in a cell and leave him there? Why did they have to torture him? And he went back, and of course he was reading all the writings of Karl Marx. It's obvious that Karl Marx was a Satanist. In this whole movement that we face today, Karl Marx, the father of communism, of Marxism, and then of course all these other very, very wealthy and powerful organizations we face, they all have a common denominator in Satanism.
Yeah. It's interesting that Karl Marx, the most commonly used picture of Karl Marx is of him showing up with his hand kind of clenched fist inside his coat by about the third or fourth button, between the third and fourth buttons. And that picture is the sign he's giving is a symbol that's about 6,000 years old and shows that he's been born again to Lucifer. So we can't confirm that Marx was a Mason, but we certainly can confirm that he was a member of the secret religion known as the ancient mystery religion. It goes back 6,000 years.
And, of course, he was actually paid to write the Communist Manifesto by an organization known as the League of the Just. Now, they don't teach that in schools. They teach you about Frederick Engels and the son of a very wealthy capitalist or manufacturer in Great Britain. But they don't talk to you about the secret society that financed Karl Marx. And that's covered in a book written by the Librarian of Congress called Fire in the Minds of Men. Certainly one of the most important books in my library, one of the five most important books. Fire in the Minds of Men by James H. Billington, which is available, of course, from Radio Liberty. So,
yeah.
And then, of course, we carry all of Ralph's books, at least we carry his New World Order, The Unseen Hand, and Masonry, The Conspiracy Against Christianity, because that's what it's really all about. And when you understand that there really is a conspiracy against Christianity, so much of what's going on in the world begins to make sense, and we understand why these people go to such lengths to try to create this idea there's a wall of separation between church and state, why the Supreme Court, which was controlled by Masons from 1941 to 1971, when they took God and prayer out of our schools and laid the foundation for the moral anarchy that we're in today. The Masons controlled the Supreme Court all during that time in majorities of 5 to 4 to 8 to 1. Gee, why doesn't anybody ever tell us that? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for those of you who would like the documentation on what I just said, the book, of course, is Behind the Lodge Door by Paul Fisher, and all the references are in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and I'm sure you've got lots of references to that in your books as well, don't you, Ralph?
Yes, especially my last book, The Masonry Conspiracy Against Christianity, because that's the book that proves it in their own literature. I walk you right through it from their own literature, that the Masons take a vow to destroy Christianity. In fact, they are told by Albert Pike, who wrote those rituals, that at the 30th degree you learn, quote, the true purpose, unquote. The true purpose of Masonry is revealed in the 30th degree. And by the way, in Rex Hutchins' book, it's very revealing that all of the degrees except the 29th and the 30th have aprons, apparently to conceal things. But in the 29th and 30th degrees, there are no aprons, which implies to me that the truth is finally revealed, what we're up to, inside the 30th degree, and that's where it is. It's inside the 30th, where there's no apron to conceal anything. It's open, available, and you can read it with your own eyes, step by step. I want to walk you through it. So Masons have a true purpose, the destruction of Christianity.
And, of course, I think it's so interesting, if you read the book Morals and Dogma, the introduction to the 32nd degree, there's a picture. It's a very unusual picture. It shows a man and a woman, the heads, but the common body. And, of course, surrounding them, they have the hands out, and there's the compass and the square, which are the symbols of Masonry, a number of upside-down stars, which is, of course, the satanic pentagrams, then, of course, the sun and the moon, which, of course, are pagan symbols, but they're standing on a gigantic serpent that overlies the top of the world. In other words, Masonry is founded and stands on the serpent. And all you have to do is look at it. And, of course, there's a little slogan on the top. It says Rebus, R-E-B-I-S. But if you spell that backwards, it's cyber, S-I-B-E-R, code. Now, ordinarily, we speak of cyber with a C, C-Y. But this is, spell it backwards, S-I-B-E-R, or Rebus. And, of course, I think they know exactly what it is. It's a code. What's the code? Why Masonry stands on the serpent that overlies the world.
Interesting. I've not thought about that, but that certainly makes sense. It's an explanation.
If you have your Morals and Dogma, you do take a look at it. It's the introduction to the beginning of the 32nd degree.
Have you read the Da Vinci Code yet, Dr. Stan?
Oh, yes, certainly. I think it's an exciting, fascinating book. But, of course, designed to deceive the Christian.
Well, it's actually worse than that. In my opinion, the author, Dan Brown, has his expert, his villain, say in the book that about Mary Magdalene that she holds the secret that would devastate Christianity, and that the revealing of the secret would devastate Christianity. And then Dan Brown has in his book, he reveals the secret, which means his purpose is to devastate Christianity. Now, there's ample evidence in that book through the symbols that Dan Brown is a Mason. Now, we can't prove it yet, but we're certainly working on it. I don't know if you notice this or not, Dr. Stan. Have you talked to anyone that's explained to you about the dust cover?
No, why don't you go ahead and explain to us about the dust cover?
I don't have one of those books, but a friend of mine took a photocopy, a color photocopy, of the dust cover of the book. There's apparently four different versions. I won't call them editions. There's the big hardbound, which is the traditional book with the dust cover. Then there's what they call a trade paperback.
No, hold just a moment here. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Ralph is talking about Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, and you have to understand that the purpose of this book is to destroy belief in Christianity. And, of course, Dan Brown says, well, of course, his book is fiction, but there are certain things that are true. For instance, the Prior of Sion, and, of course, the whole idea that the Prior of Sion held a secret. What was the secret? That Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene and had a child out of wedlock. And if that's true, that Jesus didn't die on the cross, then the whole message of Christianity is a lie. The trouble is, of course, that the Prior of Sion did not originate back at the time, you know, very early times, in the 500s or so. The Prior of Sion originated about the 1960s. It was all fraudulent. Even CBS 60 Minutes will admit that.
Yes.
But Dan Brown won't, because his purpose is to destroy Christianity, and when presented with the evidence, he insists he's right. And if he's right, then Christianity is a lie. And, of course, if he's wrong, then he is a liar, and he is doing everything he can to discredit Christianity with the help of Hollywood and, of course, the media, which just lauds and applauds this heretical book.
He points out, Dr. Stan, that the Prior Age of Sion created the Knights Templar. Now, that's real. You're right. The opening page of his book says that the Prior Age of Sion was real, and that was formed in 1099, but that's simply not true. The documentaries they're putting out now quote the man who founded it or made it up, like you said, in the 1970s. And the reason, apparently the reason he wanted to do it was to connect himself to the bloodlines of France. But that's, you could argue, who knows. Now, but notice, the Knights Templar are real. And then he says that the Knights Templar gave birth to the Masons. So if the Priory de Sion is not real, and the Knights Templar, which is the father to the Masons, are real, then that book is about the Masonic Lodge. And that's the reason he wrote it. Now, go back to the dust cover. On the dust cover, on the inside of the front, I don't know how to describe it, it's hard to describe. The dust cover is intended to keep the hardbound cover clean, I guess. So they call it a dust cover, where there's printing and et cetera on it. And there's a flap that's folded in at the front and a flap that's folded in at the back. And on those two flaps, he's written a bunch of paragraphs about what the book is about, which is fine. But at random, there's no, what's the word? No, they show up not every third letter, every sixth letter, every fifth letter, or the second letter in every word, but there are letters in bold. And when you take those letters and put them in sequence, they spell out, "Is there no help for the widow's son?" Now, That's the slogan that you say to identify yourself as a Mason to another man, and if he understands what that is, he'll give back you the same statement, which means that he's a Mason. So the purpose of that statement is to reveal that you're a Mason. And so you can only presume that Dan Brown wanted that in there. I presume he knows about it. I can't imagine the publisher doing it without his knowledge. So Dan Brown, I think, is admitting that he's a Mason. And he writes very favorably about the Masons throughout the book. So you can only presume that what he's doing is the same thing that he learned as a 30th degree Mason, if he's a Scottish Rite Mason, that they're out to destroy Christianity. That's what this book is for. His hero, his villain, says that Mary Magdalene contains a secret that, if revealed, would devastate Christianity. And guess what? He reveals the secret. Isn't that interesting?
Well, of course, whether he's a Mason or not, certainly he is doing the work of Masonry, which is to destroy belief in Christianity. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the average Christian to know. But this is a well-organized, well-financed movement to destroy Christianity. And, of course, Dan Brown is an excellent writer. I mean, I think it's a gripping book, a fascinating story. But if he just said it was fiction, it would be one thing. But to profess that this is really true, you know, reflects the fact that he has an agenda. And, of course, that agenda is the destruction of Christianity, which is the true agenda of Masonry.
Well, he also makes the point that his villains say that much of what we learned from our church fathers about Jesus is false.
Amen.
Why would he say that? Because the book has a purpose. Now, I don't know. The last word we've had is that he sold 60 million copies of that book. I don't know if that's true, but let's presume that it is. That means an awful lot of those people don't really have much of a position, and they now believe that his work of fiction is real.
Well, you hang on. We'll be back here in just a moment with our good friend Ralph Everson as we begin to explore the background of Masonry. And, of course, we're going to be talking about the Da Vinci Code. And, of course, the Da Vinci Code gets into the Gnostic Gospels. They're heretical. They were, of course, aimed at undermining Christianity. The idea, of course, that Constantine, had come up with the idea that Jesus was, he's in the Council of Nicaea, had come up with the idea that Jesus was God, and it was not until then that it came about. It just has no basis in historical fact. If it's simply be honest in saying, this is my opinion, this is simply a work of fiction. But he puts it forward as truth, and it's not. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, of course, is Dan Brown. And right now, of course, we're talking about the Da Vinci Code. I am looking at the dust cover, at least on my cover. I don't see that...
You have to look very carefully, Dr. Stan. The bold letters are not much bigger, but if you'll start reading the first paragraph on the inside dust cover, in fact, I can get my... I don't know where I put it, but I got a copy of it. I can walk you through it. But some of the letters are in bold. The first one is an I.
All right. Well, you'll have to go ahead and get that for me.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it.
All right, fine. Well, I think that basically, of course, what they do many, many times is they write in esoteric terms. They use capital letters to deify words. And if you read something like Morals and Dogma, you have to get used to reading esoteric terms. What they will do, for instance, they will take an idea and they'll divide it into two parts. A beautiful example of that would be, for instance, President Bush's second inaugural address, where he talks about, and this is the second to the last paragraph, and I'm not even suggesting George Bush even knows what's in his addresses. Somebody else writes them for him. But it says, you know, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, when soldiers died wave on wave for a nation based upon liberty, when the citizens marched in righteous outrage beneath the banner freedom now, they were declaring an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. Well, if you really, of course, take that and dissect it, what he's saying is, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled. What in heaven's name are they talking about? Well, of course, the ancient hope that's meant to be fulfilled is the new order of the ages. And what's the new order of the ages? You type it in on your Google search. It's the new order of the ages is Novus Ordo Seclorum, the new secular order. That's what it was all about. And he's saying when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope. And that's what it's about. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Ralph Epperson. Ralph, are you back yet? Well, I guess he's not back yet. We were just, he was telling me about his copy of the book, Da Vinci Code, and I just got mine out. Many times they will use they'll use this so-called esoteric writing. And as you read it through, you have to understand that it is designed to confuse you, and they will use all sorts of terms that you really can't figure out. But they will capitalize certain words, they will deify certain words, and you wonder, when they capitalize a word, why are they doing that when it has nothing to do with God or a proper noun? And they're communicating a message this way. They know exactly what they're doing, and there are certain patterns of esoteric writings you begin to pick up as you read them. There really are people who are actually communicating secret messages. In fact, we have this one wonderful book. It's called Plutarch, the Age of Alexander. It was written by Plutarch, who lived about 50 AD to 150 AD, somewhere in there. And Plutarch writes about Alexander and how Alexander was schooled in the secret mysteries of the mystery of religions. And, of course, Alexander was Aristotle's pupil, just as Aristotle had been Plato's pupil, and Plato had been Socrates' pupil, and they were all involved in the occult. And if you read the writings of a gentleman who taught back at the University of Chicago many years ago, he was certainly a very well-known professor there, and he basically wrote about how, you know, Plato always had two messages, one, of course, for the general public, and then one for the very bright students who were being introduced into the mysteries. Well, what's so significant about this book, about the age of Alexander, what Plutarch writes? He tells about how Alexander, of course, had all these wonderful, wonderful victories. And here's a man with 35,000 Macedonian troops, who sets out to conquer the world and accomplishes it. He meets the mightiest armies in the world. He meets Darius, you know, as an army with hundreds of thousands of people and elephants, and these 35,000 Macedonians defeat them. Did you ever wonder how that could happen? Well, of course, it could not happen just logically, but there was a supernatural force behind them, and that, everybody is, of course, what this is really all about. And so Plutarch writes that, Aristotle had written a book about the mystery of religions. And Aristotle was, and Alexander the Great was very displeased with that. So Alexander the Great actually wrote a letter to Aristotle and said, you have not done well. You've taught me the mysteries. When I was in your classes, I learned the mysteries. And now, of course, you've written a book and other people will understand it. And this will tend to take away my ability to be able to control other things. I would far rather control people with my knowledge than with my power. What knowledge was he talking about? He was talking about the supernatural he'd been introduced to. And then Plutarch goes on to write and say that, well, of course, Aristotle had written back and said, Alexander, you really don't have to worry. People can read all they want to about the mysteries, but unless you've been schooled in them, you won't understand them. And that really is true. You can read the writings of Morals and Dogma or so much of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and you get lost in the rhetoric. You don't know what they're saying. But once you know what the secret is, and suddenly you can begin to read these things, and the whole story opens up before you. Ralph, are you get back there yet?
Yeah, I couldn't find that, Dr. Stanley.
All right, well, don't worry about it.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to get back in touch with you because I want you to have that. You can use it yourself. I found a couple of, I've got my book of the copy of the Da Vinci Code. If people want to mark these pages down, they can do so. And by the way, one of the volumes that he's printed has more than 454 pages. So this, I've got the trade paperback. It's a little larger one. On page 235, Teabing, who's the villain, the bad guy, says, almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. Yeah? It's up. Then on page 256, the female lead, the good girl, writes that historians could never prove the documented the genealogy of Christ's bloodline. And Teabing, the bad guy, says bad guy, no more so than they can confirm the authenticity of the Bible. So he's questioning the authenticity of the Bible. And then on page 239, he tells us, once again, 239, he tells us what the purpose of this book is. He says that the woman, he's talking about Mary Magdalene, who carried with her a secret so powerful that if revealed, it threatened to devastate the very foundation of Christianity.
Of course, that was supposedly the secret of the Prior of Sion. What page is that?
Page 239.
All right.
So notice that if Dan Brown reveals the secret, its purpose is to devastate the very foundation of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he's doing. That's what this book is about. And millions of people are going to believe it. And of course, that's why he would write the book if he's a Mason. And on page 389, he connects the Masons with the Knights Templar and the Priory de Sion. 389, hold on.
All right, Knights Templar.
Yep, I made my own index, not just that. He didn't have a good index here. Page 389. I think we're still flipping here.
Well, of course, I think that the book is frankly heretical. It's part of the overall conspiracy against Christianity. When you understand there's a conspiracy against Christianity, you're going to understand so much of what's going on today.
It says here on page 389, down the bottom, he's talking about Freemasons. He said, volumes had been written about the ties between the Masons and the Knights Templar and the Priory de Sion. So there's the connection. The Priory de Sion is a fairy tale. It's not true, but he says it is, but it's not. But the Knights Templar are real, and the Masons are real. In their own literature, the Masons admit that the Knights Templar are their fathers. They're the ones who were formed after they went to Scotland, and they formed the Scottish Rite. That's where the Scottish Rite comes from the Knights Templar who escaped there after the the murder, if you will, of Jacques Desmarais.
And, of course, the Knights Templar, of course, after they were dispersed in the early 1300s, some of them, of course, had said they went to Switzerland and formed the great Swiss banking families that exist to this very day. Others went, of course, into Scotland, and you'll find their tombstones there. But they were instrumental in creating Rosslyn Chapel, which, of course, is where the book, the Da Vinci Code, has its culmination, where, of course, you build up and the secret is going to be found out in Rosslyn Chapel.
Did you notice in the book where he said that the pyramid at the Louvre has exactly 666 panes of glass? Did you see that? Isn't that interesting?
And of course, what does that mean? That means, of course, it's demonic.
Yes.
And in fact, they use that number 666 over and over again, whether it be the World Future Society with their logo, a circle made up of three sixes. Of course, they changed it when we began talking about it. Or the Trilateral Commission, a circle made up of three sixes joined together in the middle by an upside-down broken cross. Or certainly Marilyn Ferguson's The Aquarian Conspiracy with the three sixes there. Or certainly on the right side of the front of the dollar bill. It's really fascinating. If you turn it upside down and look very closely, you'll see, with the magnifying glasses, you'll see two sixes, and you know there's got to be another one there. And once you know it's there, of course it's there, along with the owl and the spider and all of these occult emblems implanted on the dollar bill. And the average person can look at it. Of course, they have all the occult emblems on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid cap by the all-seeing eye, and the slogan Novus Adoris Seclorum. And, of course, the eagle, of course, that wasn't what it originally was. It was a strange-looking bird. Mandy P. Hall suggested it was a phoenix. And then they gradually evolved it over a period of years to what you see today on the back of the dollar bill.
You got on page 281, Dan Brown makes a comment that the Mozart, his opera called The Magic Flute, was filled with Masonic symbolism. And way back probably 10 years ago, I got a copy of The Magic Flute from the London Symphonic Orchestra, and I guess some sort of actors group there. And I watched it. It's about 4 or 6 hours long, and it is indeed full of Masonic symbolism. And within 4 months after that thing was first performed in England, Mozart was dead. Isn't that interesting? And apparently his body was never, they don't even know where he's buried. And I think the reason they did that was because he might have been poisoned. And there were some claims that he was poisoned. I don't know. We'll never know, probably. But it just could well be that the Masons, because the Masons have make each member take a vow not to reveal their secrets. So if Mozart revealed their secrets in the Magic Flute, he had to take the punishment, which was prescribed. Of course, in that case, it wasn't prescribed because the prescription, as you've read, Dr. Stan, you know this, it's very bloody and gory. You cut across the throat and the neck and the bowels and everything else. But if he was poisoned, it was just poisoned. By the way, Joseph Smith, the leader of the Mormon Church, The first, quote, prophet, unquote, was murdered by the Masons. Did you ever hear that, Dr. Stan?
Yes, of course. Well, of course, there's so much Masonic symbolism within the Mormon Church.
Yes, let's talk about why. Joseph Smith formed the church in 1830. In 1842, he joined the Masonic Lodge, and he went through, some people claim 33 degrees, and I'm saying that there weren't 33 degrees. But anyway, he became a Mason. At least we'll stop with that. And I believe he only got through the first 3 degrees. But anyway, after he became a Mason, 4 months later, he released the endowment ceremony. And when you compare the endowment ceremony side by side with the Masonic ritual, you can see that the Masonic ritual is the foundation for it. It's not the duplicate, neither was the other one. But the point is that you can see that he used the rituals and symbols inside the Masonic ritual as their foundation for the endowment ceremony.
And, of course, they have secret indoctrinations or secret inductions into the upper echelons of Mormonism, exactly as you do with Masonry.
And Joseph Smith, as he was being shot at the Carthage jail, raised his arms and was saying, "O Lord my God, is there no mercy for the widow's son?" And he never got it finished. Apparently he realized he was being shot by the Masons, but didn't understand. And he thought if he gave them the sign that he was a Mason, they wouldn't kill him. And they killed him anyway. And the reason they did so was because he had revealed their secrets inside the endowment ceremony.
Well, I certainly have heard that, and is there any proof of that at all? I mean, certainly it certainly is a very plausible explanation, but do we have any other thing other than the fact that, you know, it's sort of been said for many years, but is there anybody that we know that has actually researched that?
Yes, you're talking about the fact that
he was killed by the Masons.
Oh, yeah, there's in the book by the Tanners, what's it called? Oh, boy, I can't remember the name. I read this book 20 years ago, but I quoted from it in my video. The Tanners did the research and found out there were eyewitnesses who were Mormons who repeated what he said, that he had raised his hands and he only got out, "Oh, Lord, my God," but he was killed. That was the end of it. And there are people inside the Mormon faith who admit that he was murdered by the Masons. That's all covered in that Tanners book.
And, of course, the thing is that I think that some of the people within the hierarchy of Masonry, pardon me, hierarchy of Mormonism, realize the relationship to Masonry, don't they?
Yes, I believe so.
All right, well, first of all, before I go on, I want you to get out your website and help people get in touch with you and get your material.
Well, you're very kind, Dr. Stan. If people want to read this material, and by the way, I believe that I document everything. It's my rule. I don't make statements I cannot prove. So if you want to go to my website, it's simply Ralph Epperson, R-A-L-P-H, and then Epperson, E-P-P-E-R-S-O-N. And the two words are connected. There's no space, no gap, nothing. Just Ralph Epperson, and then .com. And that's my website for all of my books and my videos and my booklets. And then I've got a fourth book out called Jesse James United States Senator, which, by the way, I believe will help the novice understand how this nation was founded and how one man, Jesse James, played a major role in it after the Civil War all the way through 1951 when he really died.
And I think, of course, the interesting thing is you've actually talked to some of the relatives of the gentleman who became the United States Senator, and they've acknowledged to you, at least one of them did, that they knew he was Jesse James.
That's correct, and I'm talking to a friend of mine who's done this research far more in depth than I have, and he's talked to three or four of the Jesse James family members who know that he's Jesse James lived to be 103 and died in 1951. But that website is Senator Jesse James, Senator Jesse James, all one word, .com. Senator Jesse James, and the other one's RalphEpperson.com. And I'd urge you, I've separated my writing about Jesse from my conspiracy stuff. I want people to read the story just by itself, and I'm hoping you'll do that.
Well, Chris, this is one of the most powerful and wealthy men in the United States, and the whole idea is that some of this certainly came from the extensive pilfering of the trains, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Stan, you know, one author that I read said that if you total up all of the money that they claimed that Jesse James stole, it totals approximately $250,000. Now, that's not enough to build a railroad. And certainly he had to split that with at least seven other gang members. So if that's not where he got his money, he got his money from the Knights of the Golden Circle, which was created by the European bankers to start the Civil War. And I document that not only in the Jesse James book, but it's in my book, The Unseen Hand. I wrote that back in 1985 and talked about the real reason we fought the Civil War. And that's inside, and the role of the Masons inside the American Revolution.
And, of course, what people do not understand is that none of the wars were ever fought for the reasons that the people who go off to fight them are led to believe.
That's
Let's
true.
Go to Eric, who's giving us a call from Compton, a regular caller. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Doc. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Got a question for Ralph.
Yes, Mr. Epperson, I was wondering if you knew anything about Charles Taze Russell, the leader of the Jehovah's Witness movement, being a Mason also.
Well, there's a book out that claims that he was a 33rd degree Mason, but I've never tried to verify that. The author's got a picture of his burial site. It's underneath a pyramid. But once again, I just leave that alone. I've not gotten into that.
Eric, I've heard the same story, but I haven't researched it.
Okay. God bless you, Dr. Stan.
God bless. Thanks so much. Okay, that was, of course, Eric calling from Compton here. And so I don't think we'll take any more calls. Ralph's only going to be with us a short period of time. Well, certainly Ralph has put together a lot of material going into the Masonic influence on America. And, of course, the whether it's today, the Masons, we don't have any Masons on the Supreme Court. We don't have our president isn't a Mason. Of course, we've had six of our last 12 presidents were either Masons or, as in the case of Bill Clinton, Senior De Molay. So six of our last 12 presidents prior to our present one were Masons. But our present president belongs to his own secret society, and that is called the Skull and Bone Society, as did his opponent, John Kerry. They both came from the secret society with about 800 living members. Isn't it interesting that those two men, one the Republican candidate, the other Democrat candidate, and of course all of these organizations have their foundations in the occult. Until we understand that, we can't understand anything going on. We are carrying the wonderful video put out by Alex Jones on the Bohemian Grove. We'll actually hear what happened when President Clinton was President Bush was asked about his membership in Skull and Bones. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ralph Everson. I was just commenting this wonderful video put out by Alex Jones. I really think it's really quite good. It's on the Bohemian Grove, and there I think it's Tim Russert who asks President Bush, you know, about Skull and Bones, and he says, "Oh, it's so secret, I can't comment." And then he asks John Kerry, and John Kerry says, "It's just a secret. I can't tell you anything about it." These are the men who are running for the presidency. What could be so secret that you couldn't reveal to the American people? Well, go ahead, pick up, Ralph. You got about three minutes to wrap up the program.
The whole problem, we need to know more about the secret societies that form this nation. I just gave a speech here in Tucson called America's Secret Destiny. It's 2 hours long and shows you the Masonic and other occult organizations and their involvement in the founding of this nation. It's really scary. It's a big story.
All right, fine. Is that available on video, or is that?
It's on a short video. I'm going to put it on DVD here pretty soon. I'm working on that. I'm getting the equipment together and learning how to do this. I don't know anything about it. And I'm a one-man crew. I'll probably have to hire someone to assist me. But I want to put that lecture on DVD. It's on PowerPoint right now, which is a program for slides instead of the old-fashioned film slides. And it's quite a devastating lecture because I'm telling you, there's something going on in this country, and it dramatically involves the secret societies.
No question at all. And when we hear the president in his second inaugural address saying, "When our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that's meant to be fulfilled." What was he talking about? He's talking about the Novus Ordo Seclorum. The new order of the ages, Google it in, it is Novus Ordo Seclorum. They understand that, at least the people who write George Bush's speeches. He may not understand it, but the people who control him certainly do.
Yes, well, yeah, you pointed out, Bill Clinton told us in 1992 that both parties were controlled by the same people. And the people, even the Democrats haven't paid any attention to it, but I did. I put out a video called Clinton's Conspiracy, in which I prove, including a clip of him actually saying that there is a conspiracy at work, and he's part of it. Bill Clinton admitted it. People here in Tucson call me a conspiracy theorist, and I call him, say, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I'm a conspiracy realist. I know it's real because Bill Clinton told me it's real.
Well, I think it's people understand that behind everything is a conspiracy against God. And if you go to the scriptures, you'll find this referred to over and over again. Get out your Strong's Concordance and look at the word conspiracy. You'll find it used so many times in the Bible. And yet, of course, anybody today who talks about a conspiracy is ridiculed and belittled and demonized. Ralph Everson, thank you so very much for being with us. Once again, your telephone number?
The phone number, 800-422-3888. That's a free, toll-free number, 800.
Hold that thought. Well, Ralph, one more time, put out your telephone number for our listeners.
Okay. Thank you. 800-422-3888. Thank you so very much, Dr. Stan. Anytime, I'm happy to do your program.
God bless. Good night.
God bless you.
All right, that's Ralph Everson. I hope you've enjoyed our program tonight, and I always enjoy having Ralph on. And, of course, we have a good time together, and there's always something interesting. He's dedicated his whole life to trying to expose what's going on. What are you willing to do to try to save America? Because America is under attack today, financially, politically, but spiritually. And when you understand that there is a conspiracy against God, everything begins to make sense. Certainly we carry Ralph's three books, The Unseen Hand, The New World Order, Masonry, the Plot Against Christianity. Those three books are available from Radio Liberty. And we also carry The Unholy Alliances by James Wardner. Paul Fisher's Behind the Lodge Door. For a good summary of what this is all about, of course, I suggest my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And, of course, we've got books by Bill Sneblin on Luciferianism. There's so much information out there. We have a video of Masonry, Friend or Foe, put out by our good friend David Wagner. So we hope many of you go to our website, radioliberty.com, and certainly look at the various items that we offer. That's radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out 5 hours a day on radio, on Internet, 4 hours a day on shortwave, and then on satellite. Let me point out that there is a move to get some of our good friends off of shortwave. And if you're interested, of course, in being able to get our programs, if anything should happen, they are available on Telstar 5, and it's a rather inexpensive satellite dish and receiver. That's Telstar 5. You can hear us, well, Radio Liberty 9 hours a day, Joyce Riley 9 hours a day. Certainly, there may be increasing pressures to get all of us off of radio, but we do still have access to the satellite. So again, Telstar 5, if you'd like more information, go to our website at radioliberty.com or call us at 800-544-8927. That's 800-544-8927. And we can put you in touch with the other people who actually are helping to install the Telstar 5 satellites. We need to be able to stay in touch. And believe me, as we move ever closer towards the destruction of freedom in America, there'll be more and more efforts to silence us. So right now you can still get us on Telstar 5, get my program 5 hours a day, Joyce Riley 5 hours a day, Chuck Chrismeyer, Pastor Butch Paul. All of this is important, so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website. Get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you're concerned about what's happening financially, you need to get our video and our DVD and our syllabus entitled The Financial Tsunami, because we're moving into very, very difficult financial times. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll tell others about our program and encourage them to listen. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, which, of course, is called The Diabolic Plan, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.